Again, this is a big day for a number of women, not just the four that were at the center of this trial, but the dozens of women who accused Jeffrey Epstein of sexual abuse and never got to see his case go to trial.
Ghislaine Maxwell has been found guilty of 5 of 6 counts by a federal jury of 12. Behind me just moments ago, the jurors delivering the verdict, the foreperson who's we don't have her identity, but it is a woman who is the foreperson, finding her guilty of all counts except for count 2, which is the enticement of an individual under the age of 17, referring to the victim identified only by a pseudonym as Jane, to travel with the intent to engage in an illegal sexual activity. That was the only not guilty count. That's count 2. But I think most important, Nicole, as far as Ghislaine Maxwell's future, having turned 60 years old just several days ago on Christmas Day, is that she was convicted of count 6, sex trafficking of an individual under the age of 18. That's tied to the victim identified as Carolyn. For her future's sake, that count carries a maximum penalty of 40 years in prison. Even if she was only to receive half of it, that would mean that she would be in jail until she was at least 80 years old.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service and host of the podcast Crime Analyst. And with me today is...
Hi, I'm Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, writer, producer of CBS Criminal Minds, and co-host of Best Case, Worst Case, the podcast. And
I am Lisa Zambetti. I'm former casting director of Criminal Minds, and I have a podcast called Killer Casting Podcast. And we're jumping on because there's news. There is news all over the damn place.
There's a lot of news, and I certainly was waiting, and I was texting both of you about the Maxwell trial because... there's been little coverage in the UK, not that I'm in the UK, but people were asking me what was happening with the case. And of course, suddenly the world's media jumped in when there was a verdict yesterday. When I'm saying yesterday, it's December the 29th. Rather ironically, I had just posted from two journalists in court saying deliberations are set to continue because questions have been asked by the jury about whether they would continue to deliberate on New Year's Day and thereafter. And because they kept asking for further transcripts to read. So it looked right, like things were going to continue. And literally within the hour, Jim, you messaged me saying there's a verdict and everything exploded.
I was shocked. I was shocked. So, yeah, typically when juries hunker down and basically they go over not only a long weekend, but a holiday weekend, you think, all right, there's serious contention in that room. Something's really going on. They're not close to a verdict. And so, and also whenever they call for information, testimony, exhibits, and so forth, that usually is a sign that there's at least some people that are arguing about a particular point or they want to learn about a particular point. So to have had all this going on and then all of a sudden a 180 degree shift, then you have a situation where they come back and it's guilty on 5 out of 6 counts. And I think we should talk about that because, first of all, the hair splitting that must have gone on to get these 5 out of 6 is crazy to me. So count one, guilty of conspiring to entice individuals under 17 to travel in interstate commerce to engage in illegal sexual activity. Multiple victims between 94 and 2004. Count two, enticing individuals under the age of 17 to travel interstate commerce and engage in illegal sexual activity. Related solely to accuser Jane between 94 and 97. Count three, conspiring to transport individuals under the age of 17 to travel in interstate commerce to engage in illegal sexual activity. Multiple victims, 94 to 2004. Count four, transporting an individual under the age of 17 in interstate commerce with the intent that the individual engage in sexual activity. Related solely to accuser Jane between 94 and 97. And count five, conspiring to commit sexual trafficking of individuals under the age of 18, multiple victims between 2001 and 2004. Count six, sex trafficking of an individual under the age of 18 relates only to accuser Carolyn. So count one, count three, count four, count five, and count six, guilty. Count two, not guilty. So she was guilty of conspiring to entice individuals under 18 to travel, but not guilty of enticing Jane between 94 and 97. However, count four, she was found guilty of transporting Jane in interstate commerce with the intent to engage in sexual activity. So she didn't entice her, but she did travel with her. So somebody on that jury must have fixated on either Jane's testimony or the proof that was put in about whether or not she actually, I'm sorry, I'm talking about GM, right? Whether she actually enticed her or just took her in interstate travel so that she can engage in sexual activity. So that seems to be the issue. And this could be a compromise verdict. It could be somebody was hung up on that one person and people agreed that, okay, we'll not find her guilty of this, but we'll find her guilty of that. And that's how they decided. And that's how they got a unanimous verdict. What did you think about it, Laura?
Well, I think it was, it seemed to take an age for them to return their verdict. And I was looking every day at the fact that they were requesting more transcripts. And I thought that was interesting because that told me they were taking it very seriously. I also understood that there were 83 pages of instructions from the judge. When you understand that, this is
that a
jury.
Lot? Is that
a new one? That's a lot. Yeah.
It is a
lot. I like to keep them like down to as few pages as possible, but 83 pages. Yeah, that's usually the judge asks both the prosecution and the defense to submit their requested charges to the jury. And the judge will handpick and kind of go through and surgically remove things and add things of their own. So I don't know who wanted the longer versions, but somebody got what they wanted.
Well, I think the charges were complex too, weren't they? Because it wasn't just about conspiracy. It was actually proving that A, Epstein and others had sexually abused the girls and that Maxwell aided and abetted, right, that she had conspired. So actually it was multifaceted. So on the face of it, it sounded quite simple. But when you start to understand 83 pages of direction that a jury have to wade through and they are requesting to review the evidence and the testimony, that tells me they're taking it really seriously. Mm-hmm. I felt good about that, actually, that they were doing that. And some people might say, well, it took 6 days. They were probably more likely to come back with a not guilty verdict.
Right.
And I did start to wobble at one point, thinking, actually, this might not be a good sign. And that's why I was surprised that they returned their verdict so quickly after asking about how do they continue to deliberate across a holiday period.
Right.
But I was optimistic from the start. I was slightly concerned about a certain psychologist who gave evidence, and we're going to talk about Dr. Elizabeth Loftus or Professor Elizabeth Loftus later on. But I think that it's a very good result for everybody, bar Maxwell and a few other people that may or may not be sweating right now, depending on their so-called medical conditions or not.
I think you're putting that kindly, Laura. I think they're shitting their pantalons right now.
I would hope so, Lisa. Yeah. I really do. And we will talk about the repercussions because there are repercussions here. But I think the message it sends out is really positive. But I do want to say it's a horrific case. It's a horrific case where victims had to go back through a very traumatic set of events. And I do want to just shout out to Julie Brown, because without Julie as a reporter, we probably wouldn't be in this position of exposing Epstein and Maxwell. And she doggedly pursued the case. And I want to shout out to the survivors, because without them, without the courage of these four survivors in particular, some of them who've decided to remain anonymous, Annie Farmer hasn't. But it takes real courage, particularly as the defense's strategy was purely about discrediting them. And it's not easy when you are knowing that you're going to be put in a situation where someone's literally going to discredit everything that you say. And that's really what the defense's strategy was. Perhaps they didn't pay attention to R. Kelly, Weinstein, and other cases. But I want to talk about that specifically because I think Maxwell was incredibly entitled throughout. So I was pleasantly surprised with the result. I think it's a really good sign. Trafficking cases are very challenging and difficult and complex. And I want to ask you about that, Jim. But before I do, I want to just hear what Lisa has to say. Oh, what did you think about it? And were you expecting this outcome?
I think I was presuming this outcome. And I did feel a great wash of relief when I heard the verdict. But and you can talk me off this cliff, Jim and Laura. I know there's a lot of Schadenfreude out there about this verdict and people really cheering it, and that's great. But there isn't a lot of fuck that bit. I mean, you know what kind of comments are out there, all these things about her, and I don't really have any sympathy for her, but that does bother me. There is just a wave of animosity and hatred towards her, which she may or may not deserve, but it seems particularly... I can't describe it, but it makes me really uncomfortable.
Well, we shouldn't be picking up our pitchforks and torches and storming the jail and dragging her out in public. That's not what should happen at this point. What I'm hoping will happen is that she wakes up and realizes that she should and has every right to open the book on anybody else who may have helped Epstein and her commit their crimes. And she should get, if she does cooperate, she should get a lighter sentence. That's how it works in this system. And if she doesn't do that, that just tells me there's some pretty powerful people. And just the fact that this trial was not covered, it just wasn't covered by any of the national media the way it should have. I don't know why the court kept out cameras. It just makes no sense to me. Why would you keep out cameras? Yeah. Why would you keep out cameras?
Was it to protect the victims who were testifying? Or?
Well, you can always, first of all, you can always have the camera blacked out during their testimony. Mm-hmm. But there's going to be a record of it. It just makes no sense to me. I just really wish that it wasn't so that we could have followed it line by line. But as you said, Laura, at least we had a couple of people covering it. And so the information came out, but it's not the same as seeing it with your own eyes.
Yes. But, I mean, Julie Brown and Lucia Osborne Crowley, I was retweeting both of them. And I have to say their coverage was really good in terms of just the play-by-play of what was going on in court. But to Lisa's point, I think because Maxwell is a woman, there's so much more hatred and vitriol. I have to say it, because that's what we always see when it's a woman on trial. I certainly didn't feel that sense of vitriol and hatred emanating when Epstein was alive, and certainly not the multiple times where he was in the spotlight and under pressure. And there didn't seem to be that tidal wave. But of course, Maxwell is a woman, and so therefore there's far more vitriol. And should she be treated worse than Epstein? Well, they clearly were partners in crime. That's what this shows, right? That they were partners in crime. They conspired together. And that's what the jury believed, despite the defense going on this very clear-cut strategy to blame, shame, and dismantle the four women's testimony.
And there had been some suggestion that this case in large part would turn on whether the jurors believed the victims. The defense tried to paint them out as people who had been willing participants and who were essentially participating in this case in an effort to make money or bring attention to themselves. But it seems clear that the jury rejected that because they convicted, according to what we're hearing on the conspiracy count involving that victim, as well on the other counts. This is an enormous victory for the government. But far more importantly than that, this is a verdict that signifies that girls who are trafficked, girls who are groomed, girls who are criminally subjected to sex in this sort of manner can achieve vindication in court, that jurors will listen to their stories, and that more people who have been subjected to trafficking should feel confident that if they report what has happened to them to law enforcement, that they will be taken seriously and that their concerns will be heard.
Their defense is that Well, these women were either bought into this memory, or they were tricked into this memory, or they basically deliberately lied about their memories. But that memory is not reliable enough. What? I'm sorry?
For money, Jim. Because I think that's this new theory that is untested, unevidenced, that suddenly was propelled and jettisoned into this case that the defense put there on the back of Professor Elizabeth Loftus. And that's what they were saying. Now, I have never heard that before, that a memory can be, something is misremembered for financial gain. And it's just so laughable. And we will talk about it in detail. But before we do get into that, I do just want to say that Maxwell spoke only once at the trial. And she said this to the judge. She said, "Your Honor, the government has not proved its case beyond a reasonable doubt. And so there is no need for me to testify." They were the only words spoken by Maxwell. What does that tell us?
Well,
I don't even understand what that means.
All right. Well, in other words, she's trying to say that the judge should just dismiss the case out of hand, not bring it to the jury because the government didn't prove their case. At the end of when the government rests and then the defense rests, the defense can make a motion for the judge to dismiss the case because the case has not been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And a judge can hear that and weigh it and say, what? The government didn't do their job. I'm not even sending this to the jury. It's very rare. Doesn't happen often. And it shouldn't happen often, by the way. But anyway, so she was basically trying to lay the foundation to this court that they should just dismiss the case, that the case is just bullshit. Well, the jury obviously spoke. And the jury said, it's not bullshit. Your defense was bullshit. And I know Elizabeth Loftus. I've met her a bunch of times. I've worked on things with her and against her on the other side over the course of my career. And she's right to a certain extent about memory. Memory is not a videotape of events that happen in front of us. Memory, each aspect of a memory is actually stored in a different part of your brain. So what you see, what you hear, what you feel, spatial relationships, emotional attachments, the smells, all of that stuff is stored in a different part of your brain. And in order to recall the memory, you have to pull those pieces together. And what our brain does, though, is in instances where we can't recall a particular part of a memory, our brain will typically fill it in with what we expect. And so you can actually, by remembering, you could actually alter parts of that memory. That's absolutely true as far as the science exists today. However, she and others do research about this, but not in real life circumstances. I hate when people try to apply a college research study to the real world. It's like when you say, oh, you can't tell if somebody's lying because of behavioral things, because here our cops can't tell, because here we had a study where cops interviewed these students and the students were supposed to take a $20 bill from this mannequin and then lie about it. And the cops couldn't tell if they were lying or not. Well, you could be damn sure that a kid who's in a college study who takes a $20 bill because he's told to is not going to feel as guilty as a person in the real world who actually steals it for somebody and stabs them or shoots them or beats up an old lady for it. Those things have different effects on people, and you can't sterilize it and put it into a study and say that trumps real life. And that's what she's trying to do in this case.
Well, she's cherry picking a bit, don't you think? I mean, Oscar Wilde once said, memory is the diary we carry around with us. And that's not really true, because people can write things in our diary, or you have to, pages of a diary can be missing. And every time you turn back to a page, it's not the same. You don't see all the other pages. And if people want to hear a really good layperson's description of memory, you can listen to Hidden Brain, Shankar Vedantam's wonderful podcast. And he interviews a colleague of Loftus's Ayanna Thomas, and she really explains how complicated memory is. And some people can retain massive amounts of details, and some people retain, as Jim was explaining, they connect dots that aren't there.
Right. You know. However, when you were the victim of sexual abuse, sexual victimization, some traumatic event, there are certain things. I mean, a lot depends on your age at the time, how long has elapsed, how much you've talked about it or thought about it over the years. But when you are the victim of a traumatic event, there's a different type of connection that's made, a very strong connection that's made between your emotions and even physical touching that's tied to this memory. And the most amazing thing, and I really want to look at this transcript. I wish I could have seen it, but in the middle of her cross-examination, Elizabeth Loftus says, because she was asked, do you actually treat anybody? Have you ever treated anybody who was a victim of sexual abuse? And she said, no, I don't treat anybody. That's right. And he said, So you really don't know anything about childhood sexual abuse, do you? And she paused and said, I do know something about this subject because I was abused when I was 6. But here's the kicker. Recalling that moment later, she wrote, the memory flew out of me, out of the blackness of the past, hitting me full force. She just fucking totally contradicted everything she testified about. She testified under oath that she was victimized at the age of 6 as part of her testimony, where she tried to discredit the testimony of people who were 17 and 14, not 6. She's talking about something that happened 6 decades or more ago, where these young women are talking about something that happened much more recently. Yet she testified under oath that this is true. Otherwise, she wouldn't be allowed to say it in a court of law. How the fuck does she get away with doing that? Why does she not at that point? I think the prosecutor should have said, Your Honor, I have no more questions of this witness. Your Honor, I'd like to make a motion that the jury should dismiss any thing that she said, because clearly she just contradicted all of her testimony, or at least argued that on closing. I don't know if he did. But what do you think about that, Laura? Isn't that insane?
Well, it is. And that's why I sent you this article that Lucia had written, because I felt it was just such a poignant article in the last paragraph. I always look at the last paragraph because that really tells me what's going on. And you both reacted to that the same as I did, because that really told the story. And of course, Elizabeth Loftus has given evidence at the Cosby trial, Weinstein, Michael Jackson, Ted Bundy, O.J. Simpson. She's testified 149 times for the defense. And I think that's really important to say as well, because her research is being misapplied. In my opinion, it comes down to the misapplication. She researches regular memory, not trauma memory. And with trauma memory and trauma brain, periphery details may change, as in you may not remember unimportant periphery things. All victims, there's no data or no evidence to say that victims do not misremember the actual traumatic events, the invasive aspect to trauma itself. You know, Basil van der Kolk wrote the book, The Body Keeps the Score, and it does. And what the prosecutors, I think, did particularly well in the Maxwell trial was they debunked Elizabeth Loftus. They asked her to talk about the studies where somebody has misremembered their trauma, and there is through research, and she had to agree there was not one study that pointed to right. that. And therefore, what they were showing is she had to say that it's plausible. It could potentially happen that somebody misremembers for money, because that was the new theory that she was part of,
spousing.
The defense strategy of positing. But there is no evidence to say that that has ever happened. So it was a brand new theory. And the prosecutors in the Maxwell case talked about rectal enema as an example, an invasive procedure. No one misremembers an invasive procedure. It just doesn't happen. Or something that happens to you invasively or some kind of sexual assault, touching, whatever that might be. So in my opinion, her research is misapplied and it is really dangerous.
And the fact that it wasn't on all counts, to your question, I think really does show the jury took this not as a whole, but in isolation, count by count, piece of evidence by piece of evidence, applying those pieces of evidence to the jury instructions, to the law, to see if each one in isolation was satisfied.
The double whammy coming that she is a survivor of sexual abuse, which flies in the face of everything that she's saying. Why would she do that?
Right.
And for her to write, "The memory flew out of me, out of the blackness of the past, hitting me full force." That is exactly what she describes as a reconstructed memory, as a memory that was forgotten for a very long period of time, and then all of a sudden comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And really, she wants to discredit that, yet she used it as a foundation for her testimony, quote, that she does know something about the subject of sexual victimization of children because she was abused.
Well, it's what's really strange is I was talking to my mother-in-law about this today. My mother-in-law, as you both know, is a neuroscientist at Stanford. She's one of the top research in her field about the brain and memory. And she knows Elizabeth too, their colleagues. And my mother-in-law was like, wait, she's very firmly in their internal circles, very against this idea of false memory. She's had arguments with colleagues that false memory is not a thing, and she's defended victims. So my mother-in-law was just in shock when I told her.
Yeah, but not when she testifies.
Yeah, well, it's very strange.
I mean, the vast number of times when she testifies, she's testifying on this subject, saying that memories can be false and misleading and manipulated over time. That's really what she says. Every time you remember something, you can manipulate it. And I believe that. But like you said, Laura, the core, the facts that this happened and the person that did it and how it happened, those kinds of things are not things that you misremember. Those are not things. What, if anything, I do think that our brains, when we go through trauma, in order not to torture us, a lot of times we edit out horrible things that happen to us. A lot of times we kind of smooth the edges around it. But we may not want to think about a bad thing that happened to us, but that doesn't mean we don't remember that it happened to us, that we don't know that it happened to us. When you see the person who victimized you, that you don't have a visceral reaction to it, like I did when I faced the guy who molested me across a table at a bar when I was wearing a wire, and in court, my body reacted to it. It wasn't something I chose to do. Or when you see something that triggers you because it was a song that was playing when you were being victimized, or it was a time of year when you got victimized. Those things, survivors remember those details. They are part and parcel of their life. And it's one of the things they have to learn to deal with in order to get on and become survivors and thrivers. Yeah. And sometimes it's even part of therapy to write down what happened, to get out those details, all those details. And many times when they do write it down, they're surprised at how detailed their memory is because they haven't sat around and really focused on it until they actually pick up a pen and put it to paper. So I just hate that when people use research like this to try to undermine people who have the courage to come forward and talk about it. All right, well, clearly this is a really monumental verdict for sex trafficking cases in the United States and worldwide. But we have so much more to talk about. So please come back for our next episode where we continue our discussion on the incredible verdict against Ms. Maxwell. Till next time, thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
the case of Sally Challen, the teacher's pet, Lynette Dawson, the Exonerated Five and When They See Us, and the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 200 0247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214-946-4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.